Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As our world becomes smaller with globalization, cultural clashes between peoples of different backgrounds seem inevitable. My guest today suggests that understanding our differences is the first step to smoothing out those rough spots. My guest, in fact, is one of the pioneers of experimental cultural psychology. Hazel Rose Marcus is a professor of behavioral sciences at Stanford University and the former director and founder of Stanford's Institute for Comparative Studies in Race and Ethnicity. Today, she directs the Mind, Culture, and Society Lab there. Her new book, Clash, Eight Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are, co-authored with Alana Connor, follows one of Marcus's most important contributions to social psychology, the distinction between independent and interdependent selves. When people use their independent side, they view themselves as individual, unique, and in control of their situations. When people use their interdependent side, they view themselves as relational, similar, and adjusting to their situations. Marcus argues that this is at the root cause of cultural conflicts from Eastern versus Western culture, global Northern versus global Southern culture, but also plays a role in gender, racial, socioeconomic, and political conflicts as well. She says understanding these differences and tempering our own tendencies is a way to bridge many of these cultural misunderstandings. The name of the book is Clash, Eight Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. It's published by Hudson Street Press. Dr. Hazel Rose Marcus is our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Marcus, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Your new book, Clash, Eight Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. When we think of cultural conflicts, we think of political differences, regional differences. We think of ethnic differences, gender differences. What you have found is a cultural part of our makeup that sort of oversees a lot of those differences, and that is whether our culture tends to be independent or interdependent. Tell us a little bit more about this.
Yeah, sure. What we have learned, integrating the best high-quality studies from psychology, sociology, anthropology, business, economics, education, is that a root cause of clashes between cultures such as genders, races, social classes, religions, even clashes in the workplace, is the clash of independence and interdependence. And let me explain what that means. All of us have two sides to ourselves. Our independent side has learned to be and wants to be separate, unique, and in control. Our interdependent side has learned to be and wants to be connected, similar, cooperative, and in solidarity with others. Now, depending on your particular mix of cultures, you tend to use one side more than the other, and tensions arise when people using their independent side come in contact with people using their more interdependent side. And our different cultural contexts, our different cultural backgrounds, foster one side more than the other. And what we find is that independent selves see themselves as separate from others, as prior to relationships. That's the key fact. Where interdependent selves privilege relationships as defining the self. And in the book, we help people to figure out whether they are more likely to use their independent self or their interdependent self, depending on their particular mix of cultural backgrounds.
At the beginning of the book, though, you really define it through perhaps one of the most vivid distinctions, and that's Eastern cultures and Western cultures. Americans,
yes,
as a rule, are more independent, although, as the book turns out, there are certain parts of American culture that are more interdependent than others.
Absolutely correct. And so we start with what people tend to think of as culture, the big East-West divide, and that comes from hundreds of studies now analyzing these differences. My own case, I spent time teaching and lecturing in East Asia, and one of my very good graduate students, she was from Seoul, South Korea. And in the small seminar, I always expect students to speak up in class because I think that's what's important for them to learn to do, to express themselves, to talk. And I was constantly calling on Hee-jung, and she really didn't want to speak up in class. She would just look down, and this was really upsetting me, and it was infuriating others. In fact, a lot of other professors on campus and actually throughout California were saying, you know, what's with Asians? Why do they sit in class? Are they just freeloading? I mean, they take, and don't give anything back. And I remember one day after I really tried to get Hee-jung to talk, she sent an email to me at the end of the day at the end of her email was the signature line, and it was the Korean proverb that said, "The empty carriage rattles the loudest," meaning that the person who has the least to say is often the most talkative. And when we talked and it became clear that in East Asian cultural context, talking and thinking are really separate activities. Here in the West, we see them as necessary for each other. And so she went on in our lab to conduct a brilliant set of studies that show that while it's true for Americans with European background, it's true that talking helps thinking. For Asians and Asian Americans, talking actually gets in the way of thinking very clearly. And that's because for European Americans, who tend to use their independent side, talking is a very important tool for expressing your unique thoughts. But for Asians and for Asian Americans, who tend to use the more interdependent sides of themselves, listening to others and having a clear mind and taking in information is a very important tool for figuring out how to relate to others, how to connect with others.
And this interdependence shows up in a whole lot of area, from education and how they educate. There was an interesting example about a Canadian teacher who had been taught to always find something good in everybody's work, even when it was not up to standard, but to find something to praise, to always give lots of good, positive feedback. He goes to teach in Asia, and his class is falling behind. He sees a colleague, and the colleague is saying, "You people are crap. You're not doing it." And it's basically scolding them. And he finds that that, in fact, works, that approach of scolding and making the Asian students feel as if they're failing actually redoubled their efforts, where in Western cultures, that would tend to make us lose interest and give up.
That's exactly right. It's a very sharp and very interesting difference. In East Asian schools, criticism is a routine part of daily activity. Criticism is a means to self-improvement. It lets you know what the standard should be and what you have to do to improve. But as you say, here in the West, we believe that children will wither under criticism and will undermine their self-esteem, and so they need praise. And what's so interesting is that what you find in studies with students at various levels, that it is indeed the case that for Americans with European-American background, praise works best for them. For East Asian and Asian American students, they are most motivated when they find out that they are not doing as well as they should. When they're falling behind is the time you see that they will redouble their efforts. European Americans redouble their efforts when they believe they're doing really well. And this has to do with these different ideas about the right way to be a self.
And you said a number of examples to show these differences. One was two gold medal winning performances. A swimmer won at a recent Olympics, and it was all I felt good. I really worked hard. I came here today. I knew I was not going to be deterred. I was going to swim harder than the other one, and I won. Another one was a Japanese athlete. Her approach was absolutely different, wasn't it?
Absolutely. What you see, and we've analyzed the primetime coverage of the Olympics over multiple years, and the Japanese athletes, instead of saying, "I reached inside of myself and I found the strength and the talent and the right stuff to do it," the East Asian athletes will focus on, "Everything came together. I had the best coach in the world. I had the best assistant coaches. I had good running shoes. I had good support from my family and friends, and this is what produced a good performance for me." And so it was a focus on interdependence and on relationships. And of course, both of these are good explanations of behavior. Both are good ways to be, to focus on relationships. And if the culture emphasizes that, that will work for you. Independence is, of course, as we know here in the West, also a very useful way to be, focusing on the self and my abilities and talents and strengths, and believing that's what's powering behavior.
Now, as our culture moves towards the East, as we turn our viewpoint more, this sort of conflict between these two approaches seems pretty basic, doesn't it?
It's a very basic conflict, and it really won't have to be a conflict if we start to embrace these cultures and try to understand them and try to use them. We see the conflict every day here in Silicon Valley. We have many high schools, and of course colleges, as I was talking about before, junior highs, where teachers are seeing students with East Asian backgrounds, and they don't understand these students. The students seem to be quiet, as I was saying before. They don't seem to be happy or smiling. They don't have the big, broad smiles that we see as signatures of American students, students with European backgrounds. And also, the parents seem very involved, almost too involved, too controlling of the students. And when they see this, they think the first thought is that something's wrong on the other side, you know, that the parent shouldn't be behaving this way, the student shouldn't be behaving this way. But with some understanding of these different cultural approaches to being a self and why they're valuable, we could do a lot to soften those clashes and bridge these divides. It helps us to look at the different cultures, not just the different families, because families are very important in fostering one self or another, but looking at the everyday interactions, looking at the media, looking at the institutions, because these differences in self, they're not inherent. They're in the cultures that we participate in, and we can change them.
I thought it was interesting, too, is that certainly there's a whole section on culture in the book in which you say that, you know, as in America, for example, the white European American culture really doesn't think of itself as a culture. And there's several sections of the book where that needs to change. We need to understand that white culture in America is a culture. But from an Asian American point of view, it's very important for them as they move out into the working world. The culture of business tends to be this very independent white American culture, and not speaking up in the workplace, not doing your work, you know, efficiently, quietly, doesn't lead to advancement.
Well, that's exactly right. In our book, what we try to do is it's an invitation for all of us to think about ourselves and also think about other people in some new ways. And to recognize that, first of all, everyone has culture. No one is without culture. And I think, as you say, you know, here in the West, and especially white in the West, tend to think of themselves as neutral people. But in fact, everybody's ethnic. Everybody has culture. We do have to recognize that. And that's one of the first messages of the book as we reflect on these differences, is to think about your own culture. And then to recognize that we have many different cultures and that we're going to have to be very skilled at using our cultural palettes if we're going to thrive in this century. So, as you say, Asian Americans in this country will soon realize that they need to not only have their well-developed interdependent self, which pays attention to relationships and privileges relationships and obligations and expectations and is very aware of oneself in the hierarchy, they have to also develop an independent self and to think of themselves as more individual and separate and unique, because that is what most American workplaces, what most American universities, that's the kind of self that is the good self, the right way to be. That's the self that is rewarded and privileged. That's not because it's the best way to be necessarily. That's the way that is built into our culture right now. Those are the institutional norms. So to advance, it will be necessary to do that. It's already the case that many Asians bump into what gets called the bamboo ceiling. They are not as well represented, for example, in leadership roles, in CEO positions, as they should be, given their proportion in the population and their very high level of achievement. So many people think, well, oh no, do I have to change myself and become some way that I'm not? What we emphasize in the book is that you don't have to only have one self. There's more than one self per customer is allowed. And in fact, in our multicultural world, it'll be very useful for all of us to develop both our independent and interdependent selves and learn to use them as appropriate. You don't have to give up your old self. You can think of these selves as resources. And so we give people a way to think about, are they more likely to use their independent self or more likely to use their interdependent self? So if you've grown up mostly here in the West, you're more likely to have a well-developed independent self. Then we talk about if you've spent time in East Asia, if you've traveled, if you've worked there, you will have some your independent self, but because of your other cultural experience, you will have some idea of an interdependent self as well, because you probably had to develop one to succeed there. When it comes to gender, women are more likely to use their interdependent selves than their independent selves. Many of the activities that women are required to do foster interdependence, but if they've worked in an all-male world, male-dominated environment, they probably have well-elaborated independent self as well. When it comes to race, as you were saying before, if you are white in this country, that's a push, a cultural push towards independence. If you're non-white, you are very likely to have a fully developed interdependent self, because people of color in the United States are very aware of others and relationships with others, because others' views of them influence every aspect of their lives. They can't not think about others. So they will likely have both independent and interdependent selves. When it comes to social class, the middle class, which we define as people with college education, or if they're a student whose parents have college education, they will have had lots of time to develop an independent self. If you've grown up in a working class background, you are more likely to have an interdependent self, where you are more aware of your connection with others, your solidarity with others.
It goes on and on. In fact, it goes into religious, regional differences.
In the South and the Heartlands, I don't know, you guys are in Tulsa.
Yeah.
That's an interesting part of the country, because it's West, South, Central. It's Midwest. It doesn't fit. It's Midwest and also Southern, but both in the Midwest and in the South, you're much more likely to have emphasis on your interdependent self than on the coast. And we do a lot of talking about that in the book, and lots of the work shows that, in fact, people in the West, South, Central really are interesting. They have very high levels of good feelings, positive affect, relatively low levels of negative affect. They're not particularly neurotic.
Mm-hmm.
People are volunteer more. They have lots of club meetings. They show up for elections more than this is true of the Midwest and on either coast. So there are many cultural forces towards interdependence.
My guest today is Hazel Rose Marcus, the professor of behavioral studies at Stanford University. And she is the founder and former director of Stanford's Research Institute for Comparative Studies in Race and Ethnicity, and co-author with Alana Connor of Clash, 8 Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. It's a fascinating book in looking at independence and interdependence and how they sort of shape a lot of these conflicts that go on within American society. We've talked a lot about East-West, but really men and women. Let's talk a little bit about that. You were talking about workplace, and there was really some interesting research done in how when women began becoming a part of what was a traditionally male-dominated field, and it goes to everything from orchestras to firehouses and to all sorts of different places. And what you found was that as women first entered those workplaces, there's a lot of conflict. There's a lot of, conflict between, but at the point in which everything equalizes, everything balances out. I thought that was really interesting.
That's right. So when you have just a small number, there is more conflict because it's this clash between these two ways of being, between independent and interdependent selves, is more evident. Typically, people aren't aware that this is what is underlying many of these clashes. When you start to get more towards 40%, then things become relatively calmer. And that's because that's when you have enough women in a given organization, some of these more interdependent ways of being can take hold. And then you will see a better outcome. Because although everyone, of course, is different, research shows that women tend to favor their interdependent sides, while men tend to use their independent sides more. So once again, both of these ways of being are extremely valuable ones. And the book is actually a call to pay attention to the importance and the value of interdependence. So many of our cultural contexts are fostering this way of being. This isn't a less good way of being. It's a particularly good way of being. And we talk a lot in the gender chapter about the upsides of interdependence, as well as some of the downsides of it as well. So a concern with others, a caring for others, is something that women, and for relationships, is what women bring to the workforce. For example, we find that the more, and we report work by some of our colleagues, the more women a group has, the better it performs on a variety of tasks. And this is an ability of these researchers. This was Anita Woolley and Tom Malone. They call this collective intelligence. And in their studies, groups with more women crafted better solutions to architectural design problems. They scored more points in a computerized checkers opponent. They were much more deft at performing other feats of reasoning and negotiation and creativity. And in trying to figure out what made the teams with more women perform better, what they found is that it was social sensitivity. And what social sensitivity is being able to understand what others are thinking, what they're feeling, and tuning into that. And in various tests of social sensitivity, women tend to score more highly than men. So that's the good side of interdependence, and it can really help make many organizations be much more effective. On average, the more gender-balanced an organization is, the greater its sales revenues, the bigger the customer base and profits, and that's what recent studies in business shows.
You know, when you look at interdependence, you know, you're seeing efforts in business to foster more interdependence, like collaborative projects within the business world, within education. You're seeing a more collaborative approach towards learning. Have we been on the wrong track by fostering this strong sense of independence? And you, in the book, you detail this from everything from how we relate in it, the educational system, to even breakfast in a home where you write in the book, you gave your daughter four or five choices
right.
for breakfast. And this is all about fostering independence. Are we on the wrong track by creating such an independent person?
Well, if we're only fostering independence, I think we are on the wrong track, because our worlds need both independence and interdependence, as you were saying. And a hallmark of an independent self is expressing the self and developing preferences and then acting on those preferences, doing what I want to do. This fosters uniqueness. And certainly I found myself in my own home with my own daughter. I put out three or four or five cereal choices, and I ask her what she wants for breakfast, and then she picks that. Then I say, what sort of juice? Is it to be orange, or was it to be cran apple? And invariably she'd, you know, ask, was there something else? Was there purple juice? You know, something I didn't have. But my idea was I was helping her to become the kind of person that our culture needs. She needed to know what she liked, and she needed to be able to express it and get what she wanted. I thought this is the way to build a good self. But in my interactions with my colleagues, often my East Asian colleagues would bring to my attention that, why do you Americans give your kids so many choices? I mean, what is that about? As good parents in East Asia, we understand what's good for our children, and we provide that for them. And we try to help our children fit in and become very good at paying attention to other people and knowing what they're expected to do, knowing what they're obligated to do. We're trying to help them build an interdependent self. That's the right self in East Asian cultural contexts. And so what I think through all of these clashes that we have analyzed, we are seeing the real strength of an interdependent self. We are social beings. We always are with others. And some of the time you want to connect with them, relate to them, understand how to fit in. At other times you want to stand out and be different. Both are basic human activities. But understanding your own cultural backgrounds, and for all of us to see which one of these selves we may be relatively more or less expert at, is a very good place to start. So, for example, again, back on women, although interdependence can be good, interdependence can also have a downside. So when a woman attempts, for example, to negotiate her salary, she's typically thinking not only about what she wants for herself, but she's thinking about what interdependent selves think about, which is relationships and her relationship with her boss and her relationship with her coworkers, and she doesn't want to make problems, and will it be fair? And so this drives many women to ask for less in the first place and to walk away from a negotiation sooner, not because they're weak or afraid, but because they're thinking about others and relationships. They don't want to jeopardize their relationships. And what this means, this is one reason why women make only 77 cents to a man's dollar. So there we would advise women, and at the end of each chapter we try to provide some beginning tips about what to do. And so for women, we talk about harnessing their interdependence for independent ends, so trying to negotiate on the behalf of your family. If you can't negotiate on behalf of yourself, think about your family, think about those with whom you are interdependent, and go in there and ask for as much as you can and drive the same kind of bargain that the men do.
It was a really interesting look at how these two forces shape a lot of the conflicts we have between men and women, regional differences, which, you know, it was interesting. I sort of expected that regional differences were on their way out, but this book reminds us that we have major regional differences between, say, Southerners and Northerners and Westerners and Easterners and Midwestern and both coasts, in race, in ethnicity, in socioeconomic class, mm-hmm. in religion. These two forces shape all of these.
That's right. And region ones, we've found that these are fascinating differences, and people are interested in them, but they're sometimes afraid to talk about these differences, so they sweep them under the rug, only talk about them in private, because this idea that people are people is a very strong progressive American idea, was that if we would just be blind to all these differences and ebony and ivory, you know, people are the same wherever you go, that would help us all get along. And that's a nice sentiment, and of course people are the same when it comes to wanting to feel like they belong and to be respected and have dignity and honor, but there also are these powerful differences, and they're something that we can embrace and use them as resources. So in the South, you know, it's definitely the case that people, and many studies show this, they tend to be friendlier. They tend to be more likely to go out of their way to help people. They'll greet people, strangers on the street. They're more likely to have neighbors who will bake cookies to welcome you. There's a lot of emphasis on interdependence. There's also some downsides of this interdependence in the South. The South, for example, is a place where they have what we call a culture of honor, and this means that people get their sense of self from other people's regard of them. This is an interdependent self, and because your reputation is so important, politeness is so important, but if someone insults you in the South, it's your duty to correct that insult, and
yes,
that's often aggressively.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the people who are the most interdependent, polite, and helpful region in the U.S., they often, they are also the most violent. So we talk about those differences, as well as differences between the two coasts. On the coast, people are more independent, use their independent selves more than in the heartland or on the South. But even between the East Coast and the West Coast, there are differences. So it's in the West Coast where people are really the most independent.
The name of the book is Clash, 8 Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. Hazel Marcus, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, I really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Hazel Rose Marcus is the co-author with Alana Connor of Clash, 8 Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. It's published by Hudson Street Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.